Hello, East is a podcast listeners. I'm speaking to you briefly at the introduction of this podcast. It is Nawaf, more commonly known as Nafi on my social media. I'm here just to announce a campaign that I've started on my Twitter for my mother. The campaign name is Match for Sarah, hashtag Match for Sarah. My mother has been suffering from a rare form of blood cancer for 15 years now, and during this 15-year period, she has been giving various medications to sustain her life. Yet, sadly, those medications were only there to do just that, and they were never meant as a cure. She has a rare form of blood cancer called myelofibrosis. The only cure for that is if she finds a stem cell transplant, a donor match. Unfortunately, here in the United Kingdom, they have searched the UK registry and they have found no match, and we are currently searching globally to see if we can find a match for her. My mother is Iranian. I myself am half Iranian, naturally. We have tried to access the Iranian stem cell bank via the NHS. However, sadly, due to US sanctions, this is proving very difficult. And so we have got in contact with various charities, among which are Anthony Nolan and DKMS, so we can access the Iranian stem cell bank via these third-party charities. However, as her son, 21-year-old man, I understand the power of social media, and hence why me and my uncle have kick-started the Match for Sarah campaign in cooperation with DKMS. DKMS operate in a number of countries, including the United States. The United States is perhaps the most important country we're targeting because of the large Iranian diaspora that exists there. With this campaign, what we're trying to do is ultimately get more members of the Iranian-American community and even the wider Middle Eastern community to come forward and to donate to the Match for Sarah campaign via the link that I will announce shortly to see if we can find a donor match for her. The more people come forward, the more people who come forward and do a swab test, their stem cell data will be on DKMS's stem cell data bank for the United States. The more people come forward and do this test, obviously, the higher the chances are that my mother will find a match. In the worst case scenario, if this campaign does not bear fruit, at least the stem cell bank for ethnic minorities in the United States and globally will be increased, so that in the future, if somebody does need a stem cell transplant, they have a higher chance of finding it. My mother's situation is urgent. She is due to undergo the transplant in May, and so we need to hopefully find a donor match by then. If not, and they will go for either myself or my younger brother, though we are only a 50% match. The link to the campaign is as follows: www.dkms.org.uk/Sarah/. Sarah being spelled S-A-R-A. My Twitter handle, if you want to see the tweet there and retweet it and raise awareness, I'd be greatly appreciative. It is at @AL_Nafy, that's N-A-F-F-Y 40. If you could go on my page, retweet the link, it's on my pinned profile, I'd be greatly appreciative. Like I said, this is a call for the Iranian American and the wider Middle Eastern community to come forward. Please, I am urging you to come forward and undergo the donation process. It's very simple. You sign up via the DKMS website, the link on my Twitter profile, and they will send you an oral swab test to do at home. You swab your mouth and you free post it back to DKMS, and they will contact you within 2 to 3 weeks to see if you are a match or not. It's that simple. You don't have to go and give blood or anything like that. There are a lot of misconceptions surrounding donating to a stem cell bank. I would just like to clarify one thing though, for the Iranian Americans and Americans in generally. When clicking on that link, www.dkms.org.uk/Sarah/, it will take you to the UK website by default, as it is a UK link. Obviously, if you are American, you will choose the second option, which is not a UK resident. The other option being, are you a UK resident? Yes. It will say initially that you are unable to register. However, it will give you a link to the United States of America DKMS website. When you go on that link, there will be an American flag. Click on the American flag, you will be taken to the American DKMS website, and from then on, you can register and apply as normally, hopefully donate, and hopefully find a potential match for my mother. I would like to thank Sina for giving me this opportunity. on his podcast to be able to display this message. The situation is very urgent. Once again, if you can come forward and donate, I'd be eternally grateful. If not, you can visit my Twitter page at @AL_Naffy40 and retweet and like to raise awareness and potentially increase the amount of people who will come forward. Okay, and now back to your regularly scheduled programming.
I'm going to press record and welcome back to the show. It's been almost a year now. And unfortunately for Lebanon, things are not any better. They're actually worse. People who might not know you from the show, you've been on previous shows before. You're a friend of the show. But maybe you can talk a little bit about your interests and sort of why you pursue this man.
Yeah, so I'm originally from the area. I was born actually in Lebanon, in Beirut, and moved to Syria, and I'm in the financial industry. So the issue of Lebanon is really interesting on many levels, on geopolitical level, but mostly on a financial banking level. As many who have followed this crisis know, it started in the fall of 2019, and really now went into a complete new phase with a significant fall in the value of the local currency. Just to put it in perspective, just in the fall of 2019, what was $10 is now $1. So it lost, you basically have 10 cents on the dollar in terms of the currency. So $1 used to buy 1,500 Lebanese pounds. It reached 15,000 this week. This is a precipitous decline that, you know, has obviously caused a tremendous amount of anxiety in the country the last 2 weeks, particularly given the speed of the decline. What is worrisome is that no one seems to know where the answers are going to come from. I mean, initially, when it started, the hope was that there would be some foreign intervention of some sort, whether it was the IMF or whether it was the US or Qatar or Saudi Arabia. Now you don't see or hear any talk of such any longer. It has really become, the country is almost shell-shocked. Once, as you know, the currency moves this fast, this quickly, by this much, activity kind of freezes. Because if you are a businessman, if you're an importer, if you are doing anything really, you have absolutely no way to price your product. And so everything got frozen now. And the hope is this morning, the governor of the central bank paid a visit to the key leaders, paid a visit to the president, and various other political chiefs in the country, trying to sort of say we're working on a plan. People are skeptical; they have no idea what that plan is. And that's where we are. I mean, how it goes from here is really anyone's guess. I think people have now sort of really understood the scope of this by the sheer fact that the currency made them totally wake up at the end and really see, wow, this is really out of control now. And that's where we are.
Can we talk about this term haircut? This is a term in finance. This seems to be the question for Lebanon, not a matter of if, but how much of a haircut. Can you explain what this means? Because
yeah,
there're probably not going to be a ton of finance people listening to the show.
Right.
At least they better not be.
Well, I mean, it's really a very, very simple issue. It's when you take your money and place it in a deposit at the bank here in New York, you would imagine when you go back to get it, you are going to get what you deposited. That is a zero haircut. you get your money back. And don't forget, in the US and in Europe and many Western countries, these deposits are federally insured. I mean, up to a certain extent, $100,000, they are federally insured. What happened in Lebanon was that they were not insured, and the insurance was so tiny that we may as well forget there was any insurance. And without the insurance, you basically handed it to a bank, and in this particular case, not just one bank, all the banks, who essentially took your money and invested it by giving it to the central bank And to get more interest. So if they paid you X, they went and lent it to the central bank for X plus 2%. And the central banks essentially run out of money to give it back to them. So if they can't get their money from the central bank, you as a depositor cannot get your money from them. And then when they realized that most of the depositors were going to be running to their banks and getting their deposits out, they essentially went out and said to everybody that we have this thing called capital control. It's a fancy name for saying we can't give you your money back. And it's not legal. There's nothing in the country that allows you to do that, but they did. And because it was not just one bank, it's all of the banks combined. At the time, it was supposed to be a temporary measure because this was a unforeseen circumstances. People were in the street. There was like a mini riots. And therefore, it was thought of as being a temporary liquidity issue, so to speak. Now, when a bank doesn't give you your money back based on liquidity issue, that is really another way of saying it is that it's a short-term issue. So as soon as they get liquidity back, it's probably they invested their money in a place that they just couldn't sell as quickly as you wanted your money back. Once they sell it, they'll give you the money back. That's kind of what liquidity means. In this particular case, it's been now over a year and a few months, and the talk is that you will not get your money back. Now, the haircut refers to, well, how much will you get back? Will you get back? Clearly, it's not 100%, but what's really interesting about this case now is that this is really the crux of it. You deposited money in US dollars at these banks, and because US dollars have run out of the country, even if you do get them back, and the base case scenario now is that they'll give it back to you in the local currency. So imagine you went into a Citibank in New York, put in dollars, and they returned it to you in some other currency when you came back to get it. That's basically what happened in this case. Again, not legal, but again, that's what they're going to do. So the decline in the value of the Lebanese pound is extremely important to your question about the haircut, because it rolls back into what happens if they hand you your deposit back in Lebanese pounds rather than dollars, which you deposited with. And therefore, if the Lebanese pound is going to be the way you're going to get your money back, and you go back and to the exchange market and exchange them for dollars to bring them back to wherever you brought them out of, then you're going to suffer a very significant loss. And these losses now, I don't know, it's anywhere between 70 to 90%, 70 to 80% on the dollar. So if you put $100,000, they paid you now back in Lebanese pounds. You took the Lebanese pounds and went and said, okay, I want my dollars back in New York now. You probably will get back only 15,000.
Wow.
So that's kind of what happened here, right? So it's really a haircut is really it's a misnomer in a way, because it sounds like a little thing. You know, we're not talking about losing 10 and 15% of the original deposit amount in dollars. We're talking about losing, maybe keeping 15% and losing the remaining 85%.
So if I get this straight, the problem here is that the relative worthlessness of the Lebanese pound is continuing to increase, and because of the importance of the dollar and the importance, like the singular importance of the dollar in Lebanon, and the banking, like as we discussed in the previous episodes, and the banking laws that encourage people to store their dollars in that account, that became kind of the priority. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just remembering our old episode.
Yeah. So why did this happen? Right. So you have what happens in countries. The way I look at the economics of a country when it comes to foreign trade is the country a net importer or a net exporter? So let's take two opposite of the spectrum here, two opposite countries here. Let's talk about Lebanon, and let's take Japan, right? Okay, so Japan exports all these Toyotas to the rest of the world. It's what we call a net exporter, which means they're exporting a lot more than they're importing. So they accumulate, when you export to the rest of the world, you're accumulating a foreign currency. Let's call it, in this particular case, it's always dollars, because that's the reserve currency of the world, right? So Toyota in Japan is selling a lot more cars outside than it's importing in various other products. It's accumulating all these dollars. It brings these dollars back to its own country and ultimately exchanges them into their local currency. And that local currency always goes up in value, because if you export, you're going to gain more foreign currency, and that foreign currency allows you now to sell it and buy your own currency with. Now, take the case of Lebanon, the exact flip side. Lebanon imports almost everything. It exports extremely little. And so what happens every morning, let's just go through a very simple example. An importer of a BMW is going to go, let's say the BMW dealership in Beirut in Lebanon needs to import 100 cars. They'll go to their bank and say, I need to import these cars. I need dollars to import them with. The bank calls the central bank and says, we need foreign currency for this customer of mine who wants 100 BMWs. The central bank makes those dollars available, and the importer sends those dollars abroad. And how does he do that? He actually gives the bank local currency, which is in this case Lebanese pound. And every day, if you think about it, if you're doing this daily, and not only that, but when you're importing toothpaste and when you're importing clothing and when you're importing cars and machinery, if you're doing this all day long, every single day, what you're doing is you're walking in the bank, you're giving them your Lebanese pounds and taking dollars. So the pressure is always for the Lebanese pound to weaken in an environment where the country is a net importer, right? So how does this get balanced out? Well, it gets balanced out if you have dollars coming into the country somehow. And that's what Lebanon did. So for the longest of times, they always had this import issue, but they have a huge diaspora who lives abroad, become very wealthy since the Civil War, resided in various European countries and African countries and elsewhere. And a lot of them were sending money back home into these bank deposits. The way in which it happened, they kind of devised a pretty smart strategy. What the banking system and the central bank said is that we always need constantly dollars to do this import business we're in, because we are a net importer. Well, to balance ourselves and to keep the currency stable, we need to attract dollars into our country somehow, right? So they say, okay, what is Citibank New York paying? It's paying, let's say, 1% on deposit rates. Well, let's go and pay 3.5% on the same dollar deposit at a very good looking bank, very decent sounding, credit worthy, beautiful building bank. And if we do this, and it's taxed only at 7% interest income, so very low taxes. And if we pay a premium over equivalent centers, whether it's Geneva or Paris or London or New York or anywhere else, we will attract that capital. And that's exactly what happened. They were able to attract roughly $7 billion a year in what we call capital inflows. And these capital inflows balanced the import deficit, the net import issue that they had. And if you wish, the sort of that was all in balance, right? So if you, yes, you're importing a lot, but you also have a capital account that is positive, and it was all a way for the central bank to stay with a fixed exchange rate that on pure economic fundamentals, without the ability to attract funds from overseas, you cannot hold the currency unchanged. It really should be weakening. That is, the local currency, Lebanese pound, should be weakening in value because you keep importing. But what you're doing as a country and a central bank is you're bringing so much money into the banking system by paying higher interest rates that you're able now to sort of keep the exchange rate stable. All this changed by the fall of 2019. Now, when people say Ponzi and then people call it, oh, it's a Ponzi scheme, what is a Ponzi scheme? A Ponzi scheme is a scheme where you need constant money coming into the system. And if you don't, the system crumbles. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Because what happens, if we go back, constantly you are attracting $7 billion a year. All of a sudden, come the fall of 2019, the inflow stopped. Once the inflow stopped, the imports didn't. The imports didn't stop. The country is still having to import almost every single thing they consume. And so you now constantly are walking into the bank, handing those Lebanese pounds, wanting dollars. There's demand for dollar. All of a sudden, there's no supply for dollar anymore from abroad. Voila, the whole thing just collapses. Now, when it did first go down, you know, it went, as you probably people who have followed this, it didn't obviously collapse in one way. Why? You know, this is the way people have hope. At the beginning, it was the IMF. People thought it was short term. People thought it was just like, you know, this was not going to be as bad as some of the skeptics like me and others from day one who said, guys, this is way, way more serious. You know, the losses on these deposits could be in the 80% handle. This looked or sounded really ridiculous at the time. But now, as people really started to absolutely see the case that there is no way to solve this problem other than the currency continuing to depreciate the way it did, you know, it led to this last precipitous drop where confidence completely evaporated from the system. Politicians are like literally like deer in a headlight. No one wants to take responsibility. No one knows what to do. And the system is frozen. And that's basically where we are.
So I've heard this someplace that every sort of central bank is a Ponzi scheme, in a sense. That like the idea of a central bank is like a legitimated Ponzi scheme. That the way that like the cops are a legitimate use of force, sure. Right? That like this is a necessary thing that large economies like ours need.
Sure.
They need this source. Because the American solution to a lot of problems, or I guess this is a common solution to a lot of problems like this, is just to print more money, right? The situation in Lebanon is that the addiction to dollars and this need for more dollars, and then at the cost of what? Like it's almost like a like an addict problem.
Well,
like you're just addicted to this thing, and it's more and more harmful to your system the more you continue with it. But
it's a little
here
different.
We are now.
It's a little different in Lebanon. Here's why. In the U.S., let's talk about U.S. central banking. Your liabilities and your assets are in the same currency, right? So if you can print your own currency and you are owed money in your own currency, that's fine. If Lebanon didn't have the deposits all in dollars and they had them in Lebanese pounds, there wouldn't be a problem. I mean, you can have inflation, but you can pay everybody back through inflation. You can pay every presumably, right? If everybody wants from you Lebanese pounds and you have the printing press to a Lebanese pound, you can meet your liabilities. Now, your money will be worthless, but you can meet them. There's no technical issue. What's happening in Lebanon, it's almost like saying in the US we basically borrowed a lot of euro or a lot of yen and now we have to pay it back. And the dollar is collapsing in value. We, you know, like a central bank that is dealing in their own currency, what makes Lebanon really unique is that the central bank owes the commercial banks who owe the depositors a foreign currency that they cannot print. That's the problem. It's if it was all in your own currency, it's one thing. It's the liabilities denominated in a currency you have no printing press for. And what everyone wants. People do not want to take your own currency. They want dollars. They brought dollars. They want dollars. Rightly so. Now, you're saying to them, effectively, I spent your dollars. I don't have access to dollars. And therefore, I cannot pay you back for now. It started as a temporary measure for now. And that has gone on for long enough now that it's become almost a permanent feature. And people don't have access to their money. And meanwhile, the local currency continues to fall because it is realizing that there are no dollars in the system. And the ultimate solution is to give it all back in local currency. And if you're literally, you know, throwing toilet paper into the system, and the value of something whose supply is going to go up so much is going to fall in price.
The idea of what Lebanon, because Lebanon is a small country, right?
Yes.
And it's dependent on a lot of external forces.
Yes.
Now, it seems that those external forces have irrevocably changed, right? Flow of money, the dream of, you know, Beirut as this neo place of coming together of tourism and everybody in the region meeting here and all the stuff they said in the 90s, right? Like the dream of the 90s of rebuilding this destroyed country will then attract foreigners, will, you know, right? The thing that we hear a lot from neoliberalism in general, like the same thing that happens in, like, you know, poor neighborhoods. They get gentrified by people with big ideas, usually from not the poor neighborhoods, right? Like now, like 30 years after the end of the war, it's been 30 years. And I mean, there's been intervening wars, which is to say that Israel has bombed the shit out of the country a bunch of times since, which then adds to the problems of Lebanon, not just in terms of life quality and just misery of the people, but setting back a country infrastructurally, whatever, for decades to come. Now there's no financial sort of, now there's no sort of, what's the word? Like, there's no oil going into the system to then keep this going, right? Like, there's nothing to... So how do... Okay, so if the problem is dollars, right? Like, you would have been smart. Like, it would have been smarter for you to be that weird guy who's, like, in his 50s who stashes his dollars underneath his bed. It would have been smarter if you were, like, that guy than if you were, like, than most middle-class people who trusted a bank. Is that the case in Lebanon?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, let's sort of... We talked about finance, but obviously, let's talk about the politics of this. So you're right. I would say Lebanon, let's call it, is caught in two camps. One camp wants a Western direction that, you know, they call, let's be neutral, meaning let's stay out of the Israeli-Arab war, let's stay out of getting in trouble in the Syrian war, referring to Hezbollah in this case. Let's just stay out. Let's just be Switzerland. Basically, that's the notion here. And by that, the meaning is we have this Western, the way you described it, we have this traditionally Western a pivot. Let's do that, and that would be more healthy for us than getting involved in these regional issues. Now, you know, in more practical sense, what that means is that the president of the country and the leading party, which is Hezbollah and the Tayyar, the parties in control of the politics, if you wish, is not this pivot. It's actually the other pivot, which is the pivot that says we want resistance against Israel. We, you know, and it's this particular camp is seen as a pro-Iran or Iran supports this group, and once that has come into the mix, the traditional Western involvement in Lebanon took a complete backseat. In fact, I would go a step further and say that the way they are looking at it is like, let the system go down because it's run by these guys who are not our friends anyway. And so if it's all going to collapse and our guys will come and take it over, then so be it. And so if you look at the sanctions that were imposed on Syria, and you have Hezbollah and President On in Lebanon who are pro-Syria, well, these two then, if they're going to fall, let them fall together. That's sort of one part. Now, the population is split as well. I mean, when you look at elections, they go into parliamentary election. Of course, this camp has won the election, but the other side says this is not fair elections. And so, you know, Let's call it like the country is caught in these two camps, and the Western help and the Gulf help will not come because it is perceived that the leadership currently in charge is pro-Iran. And if it's pro-Iran, no Saudi or Qatar or UAE is going to come and invest money in this country right now. So the early hopes in the crisis that these countries were going to show up, you really don't hear it anymore. You really don't see that type of, you know, talk taking place at all as of late. Now, this could change, but for the moment, the politics of it is really what's making it very toxic. I mean, the two sides are on two opposite extremes. Each side feels that you are trying to, I mean, the president and Hezbollah and so on are viewing the attacks on them as essentially a way to get this economy to go into a complete tailspin so that they lose power, everything collapses, and a new regime basically takes over, or the Western camp takes over. So in this case, the economy and solving the problem became, you know, essentially a tennis ball here that people are just bouncing to each other. They say, "Oh, it's your fault." Finger pointing. I mean, today Hariri, that represents the Western camp, was visiting the president that supposedly presents the other camp, the Iran camp, and the meeting was terrible. I mean, they walked in. Some people, you know, each there's finger pointing. There's no one in charge. No one knows who's going to form the government, who's going to lead the government, and so the politics and the financial part are intermingled in a major way, and this is what makes it really almost like an impossible thing to solve, because the outsiders who are going to come in, if they do come in, need to have the confidence that they are bailing out their friends. They're not coming here to bail out a system that they don't want to be around anyway. So why would I come and help you? If I'm Saudi and I think I'm coming to help the camp that is a pro-Iran camp, why on earth would I send a cent into this place? That's basically why we're stuck.
The port explosion.
Yeah.
Excuse me. The port explosion. We have not spoken about it. Can we talk about something that I had seen on a YouTube video a couple of months report shortly before this explosion at the Beirut port? There was a report that there was a sort of revelation that China had made a major deal to develop this port. Do you know anything about that? Could you speak to that?
No, I don't. I don't believe there's any such thing at all. I mean, this is talk that took place part of. I'm not aware. I mean, obviously, I don't have expertise in this area, but clearly, I don't believe that China was involved. Look, this port issue, it's again part of the same problem, the political issue, right? Because, you know, everybody that day thought it was all Hezbollah. People who still hate the Hezbollah camp still believe it was all Hezbollah. The other side is saying it's not. The legal system tried to get some people indicted, and the judge was fired. It's a complete utter mess. I mean, it's just a microcosm of the country's kind of, you know, cut into factions, and there's really no one decision maker here. I mean, it's really five or six people who are all trying to protect their own, the traditional five or six. I mean, there's nothing new here, and nothing has changed. And whether it's this crisis or the banking crisis or the port, it's just going to be the same thing until, you know, until what? I don't even know until what. I mean, like, presumably if the Iran part completely loses and the other side comes in, and then the US comes and helps, and the Saudis and everybody, and that's kind of the old style sort of way that you describe it, Lebanon of the old, of the Western side. That is extremely difficult to implement because of the obviously power on the ground of Hezbollah, of ON and the Tayyar group. And this is why you have these problems.
Just yesterday, recently, Russia, Sergei Lavrov and Russia visited with Hezbollah officials. The significance of this, I think, is pretty open in terms of, I guess, in a sense that it's pretty clear now that Russia is considered the main, one of the sort of central arbiters of the region now. Like, it has far more credibility than any other party, at least in the majority of the eyes of the people, it seems to be. They're the ones who have been convening the Astana process, right? If I'm mistaken, I think they also, I think it was also Russia who kind of negotiated the ceasefire. I'm pretty sure in Karabakh. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, look, there's no doubt that what you're referring to is the recent effort by Russia to really bring the Syrian file into the fold. The trip that you're referring to was a trip made to Gulf capitals to try to solicit their help in bringing Syria back into the Arab League. Now, the UAE is obviously the leading country in favor, at least one of the important countries in favor of this. The foreign minister made it clear that while we would like to do this, the Caesar law that the US passed makes it extremely difficult for us to get involved in the country because of the sanctions that will be imposed on any single UAE individual getting involved. And this is all part of two things. As you know, the Syrian president is about to be going into his own sort of, you know, renomination or re-election or referendum, whatever you want to call it, campaign soon, within the next couple of months. So there's going to be some noise on that. There is a feeling that the country is under sanctions, having tremendous amount of problems. And the Russians are trying to do, being in the country militarily, having gotten involved, they're trying to see what they can do to bring the Arab capitals into this and get them to help bring Syria back on some form of, you know, back into the system, so to speak. And they, knowing that Washington is not going to be, you know, really getting involved at this stage with this, the new administration has the Iran issue, the Iran file issue ahead as a priority. And I don't believe they are going to get their hands into Syrian issue at this stage. And therefore, the Russians thought, well, this could be the ideal time to go and get them involved. Now, with that, obviously, Hezbollah and all the players in the region, because it is the Syrian file, whoever is involved in the Syrian issue, you know, would probably be consulted and would be brought in. And this is why they were there. And as I said, I view the incident you referred to as being part of that effort by Russia to bring Syria into the Arab League, or rather back into the Arab League.
Part of the problem in Lebanon is the relative instability of the region, relative being keyword here, but in the sense that, like, the let's say the indeterminacy of the Palestine question always mm-hmm. looms over a country like Lebanon because mm-hmm. of Hezbollah, because of Zionism too, for that matter, mm-hmm. quite frankly. Mm-hmm. Like, in that sense that this is very much still a region in the midst of a war, not just Syria, but, you know, like, this is not exactly a stable region.
100%.
So it's hard to do business in this region. So you need to, you know, attract people in these different ways. Maybe is the lesson of Beirut, post-war Beirut, and I know this is you and I are different political persuasions sure. on this. Is the lesson from Beirut, don't open up, that build your indigenous industries, make yourself self-reliant?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, look, what you are referring to, there's no question that this is a conversation that the Lebanese public is having now, and looking back and saying, what if, and we should have, could have. Of course, absolutely. There's no doubt that once a country, you know, either goes in sanctions or has a tremendous foreign currency shortages, you know, the idea that you could have had domestic industry and so on absolutely becomes to the forefront. And this is something, you know, every developing country ought to discuss. And if you can implement the strategy to do that, you absolutely must. Of course, the devil is in the details. I mean, Syria tried that in the 70s. It was great, but as you know, these things. I mean, literally, the Soviet Union tried that as well, and it's pretty hard. Korea did amazing. I'm talking about South Korea in this case. So, look, I mean, industrial policy and supporting local industry is something I think is a dream of every development economist and every policymaker. So yes, I mean, I think to your point, and speaking specifically in Lebanon, there's absolutely a revisionist attitude taking place about what had happened and if things could have been done differently, certainly in agriculture or in light industry. Yes, no doubt about it. Now, on the regional front, you know, so long as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict exists, Hezbollah exists. And this tensions in the region exist, and they're not going away. And people who are on the Western pivot part of this, you know, now, I mean, let's also not forget that there is the Abraham Accords and the UAE's, even though I'm not a believer that this is a huge game changer, because this is just...
You mean the Abraham press conference
right.
series?
I mean, the sort of peace accords. You know, let's not forget this is a country that already had established relationships and so on. But the hope was, there was a glimmer of hope that this could lead others down the way. UAE, you know, is a pretty powerful player in the region, tremendous financial resources. They could presumably one day try to nod other countries along. You know, so look, there is that part. One shouldn't lose completely hope, you know, that something like that can happen. But I would argue that the lopsided nature of the conflict, there's one party of the conflict that is so much more powerful than the other, that makes, you know, the Syria, Palestinian, Lebanese kind of part of this issue with Israel really very difficult to solve. Let's be realistic on this. And so, yeah, this region is sadly going to remain in this trouble for a while. It's going to take a significant game changer to do this. What that is, you know, I don't know. I mean, we can talk about, like, you know, many wish, almost like a wish list, but they are right now not very credible sort of, you know, alternatives.
I know you have to go by 7. It is 7 now. If you have time for one last question, I would like to ask you, though, is that, can we talk about Lebanese purchasing power? Because we've talked about macroeconomic things, like the example, actually, I think you cited this last time too. This must be where your brain goes, but about BMWs or Mercedes or whatever. Like, not everybody is a Mercedes dealer. Like, I'm just a regular dude. I work at a job in Lebanon.
We could have used Toyota dealer. The Lebanese love BMWs. They're way more than Toyota.
Yeah, white ones.
That's why I use BMW.
Yeah, Iranians too. But like actual purchasing power, what's happening there? Like, what's life happening there?
Well, very, very simple, really. Just I'll make it as simple as this. If your salary was $500, you're obviously getting paid in local currency. Before the crisis, your salary, let's say, was $500 a month for an average person. Now that salary is 50. I mean, that's basically, that is exactly what we're talking about. This is a significant, significant issue. I mean, and Lebanon is not a cheap country because the currency was very stable. It was kind of dollarized in a way. I mean, you grab a cab in Beirut, it's not cheap. And so all of a sudden, if you are talking about your income, you know, going from 500 to 50, I mean, that is a pretty significant, you know, social and economic problem. And you're sort of seeing them on the streets, you know, on a daily basis now. I mean, you're seeing, you know, people close certain streets with trucks and people getting angry. They can't get food. There are still some products that are subsidized by the government, very important food staples that are subsidized by the government. But the central bank and the government have made it clear that the funds are running out and those subsidies will be gone pretty soon as well. And that's, I think, what you're looking at. I mean, the public is aware of this now. And yeah, I mean, unless something dramatic happens, I would say imminently, this is going to go pretty badly over the next couple of weeks and months.
Well, not a delightful topic to discuss, but thank you for your time, sir. This is always depressing to talk to you.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I'm sure one day we're going to have a discussion on this region that is very, that ends on a super positive outcome. I'll make sure I'll call you as soon as I see you.
Well, thank you, sir. Listen, okay. I'll keep you going. I'll let you go. But thank you again. I'm going to have this up super quick. Have a good night.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.